Christian Educational Ministries is pleased to present Ronald L. Dart.
I think it is safe to say that every Old Testament prophecy grows out of a definite historical situation. Kings are named, locations are identified, people are described. Most of the prophecies can find some historical fulfillment within a very few years of the prophecy having been given, because those prophets, when they came on the scene, were prophesying having to do with named kings, named countries, circumstances the people knew, and the fulfillments were a generation ahead, maybe, sometimes a little further than that, but usually within the lifetime of people who were present when they heard the prophecy originally given. It comes as a bit of a surprise then to the casual reader, at least I think it would be if you were going through it and did not know what to expect, to find clear and unmistakable references to the last days in these same Old Testament prophets. Because here you are, you're reading about a king who is in existence in the same century in which Isaiah is speaking, or Jeremiah is writing, or Ezekiel is writing. And that those things are supposed to happen to these people. And immediately following these things is a restoration. It's the messianic kingdom. It's what we call the millennium. Every man under his own vine, under his own fig tree. The child, you know, playing on the den of the snake, and a bear lying down with a lamb, and a little child leading them. All that stuff right together. And so a person might wonder, there are even some oblique references to the resurrection. So here they are. And these references, by the way, are not set apart. They are woven in as a part of a seamless narrative of the events and people who are long past. Now, we've learned, as a result of study of these things and giving some thought to it, that there's a principle involved in it which we call type and antitype. The words are taken from the Greek, and they're used in theological journals and in commentaries and so forth in discussing some of these prophecies. A type, the Greek word type, simply means a model or a pattern or an image. Antitype is that later type, you know, the later fulfillment of that model. And so you have what takes place in the Old Testament is given to us as a pattern of something that is to exist at the end time. So when you look at King Hazael of Syria, when you look at the kings of the northern tribes of Israel, when you look at the invasions and the people going back and forth and the captivities, these things are presented to us as models of something that's to take place at the end time. One of the classics that's New Testament is the seven churches of Asia mentioned in Revelation 2 and 3. These seven churches, specific literal churches, who existed at the time John wrote, who had the problems that John described, with the people present that John named, are a type of the entire church of God at the end time. That's why there are seven of them. Seven means whole or all. So this is what we mean by type and antitype. And we consider then, as we read through these things, that because of the way they are presented to us, as a seamless discussion, we begin to understand that what has happened back then is a type. It's a model. It's a pattern of what's to take place at the end time. Now, you have probably heard the old expression, history repeats itself. It's true. It does. However, it is a key, what a musician would call theme and variation. You actually have the theme presented, but then it is repeated later on with different variations. Different people are there. Hazael, for example, the old king of Syria, is long dead. But there's going to be somebody toward the end who will match this man as far as the things that happen to Israel and the things that are to be done. So we understand these things. The problem you run into, though, when you read the Old Testament, is who are the people described and where are they now? What I'm talking about is prophetic identities. We read about Israel in the Old Testament. Well, who would they be now and where are they now? Or are they somewhere now? We read about Babylon in the Old Testament. Who would be Babylon now, today? Who would be Assyria? Who would be Moab? Who would be Ammon? Who would be Edom? All these peoples round about Israel who played very heavily in these prophecies, which we look at, read, and in context, we have to understand them as models of an end-time event. Well, there's an important thing for you to understand, I think, is that there are at least three ways in which people are identified in the Bible for sake of understanding the antitype. And I don't know if that has really been developed for you before, but I'm going to today. The first is ethnically, and that's the way we generally tend to think of it. That is, by their genes and their descent. In other words, who was your daddy and who was your daddy's daddy? And the idea that is presented in many of the books about the identity of Israel in the end time, like Judah's Scepter, Joseph's Birthright, and then all the spin-offs that have developed from Herbert Armstrong's book to Raymond McNair's book to I don't know who else has written books, spend a great deal of time tracing the ethnic identity of the American and British people to identify us as the descendants of Joseph. All that is really very fascinating and worthy of your study to spend some time with it. My approach to this today will not have to do with historical study or trying to trace people genetically, but more looking at things from a biblical point of view. But from a biblical point of view, the son of an Israelite is an Israelite no matter the lineage of his mother. I don't know if you've given that an awful lot of thought, but the truth is Moab Ruth was a Moabite, right? Who was an important person in her lineage? You know, King David. Was David an Israelite? Oh, yeah. Just because one of his grandmothers was not had nothing to do with that, because the lineage goes through the men in the family. Whoever your father was, that's your lineage. That's your genetic nationality. And that has some fascinating implications for people that we know nowadays. In fact, I think most black people in this country, somewhere in their lineage, have a white father, which would make a black person, because of the fact that his father, grandfather, great-grandfather, or great-great-grandfather was white, makes him an Israelite. Not many people think about that. And so consequently, when we talk about Israel or being Israel, for some people this is a racist doctrine. For some people, it has to do with racial supremacy, in particular, white supremacy. Sorry, from a biblical point of view, it doesn't work that way. And so that's not implied by any of the things that I'm talking about here. No one is one-eighth Israelite. You are 100% Israelite if your lineage can be traced to an Israelitish father. The second way in which people, though, are identified in the Bible, and this is something that I don't think we often give enough credence to, is geographically. And by that I mean we identify them by the land that they occupy. Now, for example, you will find that the Bible will talk about the land of Egypt in prophecy. The chances are what it's talking about is not the old Egyptians ethnically who lived in Egypt. It's talking about the people who inhabit Egypt at the end time, who, if you look at Egypt today, these are not the same people that built genetic descendants of the people who built the pyramids. They are not the true Egyptians that once upon a time inhabited the land of Egypt. The land of Ethiopia is mentioned in prophecy. The chances are it's talking about the people who live in Ethiopia, having nothing to do necessarily with their lineage. That is true of many of the things that you read about in the Bible. Now, it's probably true that Moab and Ammon have never left their land. And so when it speaks of Moab and Ammon, probably it's talking about the people who are living in the very lands that Moab and Ammon occupied in the old days in the Bible, which is basically Jordan. To some extent, it may have also been some part of this side Jordan, but it is Jordan and the areas to the south of Jordan. A very major player in the prophecies of old times was Edom. And yet, it's very, very difficult to try to identify where Edom is today. The fact is that if we're talking about the land of Edom, we're talking about that part of the Middle East that is from, let's say, the southern fringes of Jordan on south to the Gulf of Eilat, on the other side of the Dead Sea. That is the land of Edom. How far out it goes, the biblical boundaries are not clear at all. But there are people there. There have been people there from time immemorial. And they figure very strongly in the prophecies, in the events, in fact, of the history of Israel of old. So the peoples that have been in that area always figured very strongly, Edom, Moab, and the children of Ammon. They may well be the people who are living right in those same geographical areas today. It is possible, but it's doubtful, that Assyria and Babylon are really references to the land that they occupy. There is a fourth way, and I didn't put it in my notes today, but I really should mention it while I'm at it. There is another way in which nations are identified historically, and that is by their gods. Now, when you think about it, you know, well, yeah, sure, that's true. They actually were identified by who their god was. What may not be as apparent, though, is that those gods were probably manifestations of individuals in the spirit world who were the dominant spirit in that particular country. I gave a sermon years ago entitled The Tracks of the Devil. If you've never heard it, drop us a line. We'll be happy to provide a copy of it for you. But in that sermon, I draw, by using careful biblical examples, the fact that nations are dominated by spirit beings. That whenever in the book of Daniel, Michael the archangel is sent to Daniel, and he is withstood for 21 days by the prince of the kingdom of Persia. So there was a prince, that is a spiritual prince, strong enough to withstand the archangel Michael, who could fight him off for 21 days, and he was the dominant spirit and leader of that country. And so that spirit actually moves, goes wherever it will, and has not died. So this is what when I say that it's possible but doubtful that Assyria and Babylonia would be prophetically references to Iran, which is basically the land now that they occupied in times past, is the area we now call Iran. That Iran would in the end time play the role of Babylon is highly doubtful. But Babylon was ruled by a spirit in that time. And from anything we can tell, that spirit moved west, but that's another story. And but then that brings me to the third area that I had in my notes, or the fourth area in this case perhaps, of the ways in which nations are identified in prophecy. And that's typologically. Now, what in the world does that mean? It means by the role that they play in the events. Germany, for example, regardless of their ethnicity, regardless of their genetic history, regardless of their geography, they played the role of Assyrian, of the Assyrian, to Western Europe in two world wars. That the same basic pattern, the same basic approach, typologically, the pattern was followed in those two wars, all the way to mass deportations, which were first of all practiced by the Assyrian. So when you think about the identity of nations, you need to consider the fact that they can be identified ethnically, or geographically, or spiritually, or typologically, which is pretty closely related, I suppose, to the spiritual application. So when you put all this together, and you bear in mind that with prophecy, we are trying to understand the end time by what we saw in history. In Isaiah 41, verse 21, Isaiah says this, "Bring forth your cause, show your strong reasons. We want you to prove that you're gods. Show us the former things, that we may consider them and understand the latter end thereof," or show us things to come. In other words, the way in which you go about developing an understanding of prophecy is by looking at what happened before, which provides a model for what's going to happen later on. The purpose of prophecy, and it's important to understand this, is not to satisfy your curiosity about what's going to happen in the future. I'm just beginning a new set of broadcasts. I've taped two now on the real prophets. And I started out by talking about Nostradamus and all of his predictions, which people are fascinated about, and gave several illustrations and examples of Nostradamus' predictions. The problem with them is, of course, for the one, it's very hard to understand for sure what he's talking about. But even so, there is no reason why his prediction is given. It's just there. And there's nothing you can do about it. No change is called for. No response is called for. In fact, the implication is that what he's predicting is going to happen no matter what anybody does. That's not the way biblical prophecy works. It works, rather, the purpose being to tell you why this is going to happen and to give you a chance to do something about it and to establish the hand of God in history. Now, I've told you all that to call your attention to a curious anomaly in two Old Testament prophets. Nearly everyone understands what the Old Testament writers mean when they speak of the house of Israel, right? Basically, we know it just is talking about really the dynasty of Israel, the government of Israel, the country or the nation that we know of as Israel. In early terms, the house of Israel was the United Kingdom under Saul, then David, then Solomon. It was entirely united, and whenever they used the term in those times, they were speaking of all the Israelite tribes, all 12 of them. After the division of the Israelite kingdom, after the death of Solomon, now to refresh your memory, when Solomon died, the people who came along, his son was Rehoboam, and Rehoboam ascended the throne. And Rehoboam got advice. He got advice from two sources. First of all, the people came to him and said, "We want you to reduce the burden of taxation upon us." Solomon, all the wonderful things he did, was incredibly expensive. It was a crushing burden of taxation, and we feel the time has come to give the people some relief. Rehoboam sought advice of the old man, and they said, "Listen to the people. You listen to them, you hearken to their voice, you make their burden lighter, and they will serve you forever." The young men said, "No, no, no. You tell them that your little finger is going to be thicker than your father's loins. He chastised you with whips, I'll chastise you with scorpions." He took an arrogant, dominant approach. What happened? The 10 northern tribes, led by a man named Jeroboam, split the kingdom, revolted, and said, their expression was, "To your tents, O Israel, what do we have to do with the house of David?" And so the kingdom was divided from that time forward. So when, from this time forward, when the expression house of Israel is used, it is used specifically of the 10 northern tribes with their capital in Samaria, led by Joseph, and divided into the two tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. The remaining tribes in the south, Judah, Benjamin, and Levi, were distinguished from the house of Israel by the expression, the house of Judah. Now, you may have known that. You probably did know it, at least at some level. But I wanted to be sure and get that established in your mind. So that up until the time of the divided kingdom, the expression, the house of Israel, meant everybody. Then comes the divided kingdom, in which there is a distinction made between the house of Israel and the house of Judah, so that people would know what they were talking about as when they discussed it. Also, you should understand that the house of Israel and the house of Judah were political designations. They had to do with the government that actually held these people together. It's what we today would call nation, although the idea of a nation was not really developed among peoples in this particular time. But it meant the nation of Israel and the nation of Israel looked at as political entities in their countries. The separate house of Israel was founded in about 975 B.C., don't worry over much about the dates. They're just sort of for a general frame of reference. It fell in about 722 B.C. after some 250 years of separate existence. The United States, by comparison, I think now has been in a separate entity for 220 years. So they lasted longer than we have. They were 250 years as a separate entity. And all during that 250 years, they were the house of Israel, and the government in Jerusalem was called the house of Judah. The house of Israel was carried captive by the Assyrian king about 722. Now, in Ezekiel 17, there is an important passage of Scripture I want to go through with you just so you can kind of get the picture of what took place. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, began Hoshea the son of Elah to reign in Samaria over Israel 9 years. You got two kings, and they're giving you the time reference based upon the king in Judah. He said Ahaz was the king of Judah. In his 12th year, a man named Hoshea began to reign in Samaria, that's the house of Israel, and he reigned 9 years. And he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, but not as bad as some of them before him. Against him came up Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria, and Hoshea became his servant and gave him presents. So he became tributary to it. And the king of Assyria found conspiracy in Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to the king of Egypt and brought no present to the king of Assyria as he had done year by year. Therefore the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. Just old politics as usual. You know, he decided, "I'm getting tired of paying this guy. I'll see if I can make an alliance with Egypt instead. It'd be cheaper. And the Egyptians will protect me against the king of Assyria." Didn't work. The king of Assyria came up all through the land, went up to Samaria, besieged it for 3 years. In the 9th year of King Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away into Assyria and placed them in Hala and Habor by the river Gozan and in the cities of the Medes. Now, again, we're about 722 when this takes place. Gozan, the river Gozan, and the cities of the Medes are really very much to the north and east of Israel proper. You'd have to look in the back of your Bible at your maps that you have there. But it was not in the area of Babylon. It was in the area of Assyria, which is considerably north up the Euphrates rivers and in that area up near the foothills, frankly, going up into the mountains of Turkey. Okay? Therefore, the Lord was very angry with Israel, in verse 18, removed them out of his sight, and there was none left but the tribe of Judah only. And Judah did not keep the commandments of the Lord their God, but walked in the statutes that Israel had made. They had a whole different set of laws in the north. Well, Judah followed them. And the Lord rejected all the seed of Israel and afflicted them and delivered them into the hand of the spoilers until he had cast them out of his sight. For he tore Israel from the house of David. I mean, he just absolutely tore them away so that you have the two different tribes, the two different kingdoms. Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord and made them sin a great sin. For the children of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam, which he did, and they never did go away from them. You know what he did? He did two significant things. He changed the location of worship to two cities in the north, and he changed the Feast of Tabernacles from the 15th day of the 7th month to the 15th day of the 8th month. He changed the holy days and the place you're supposed to go keep them. He did this until the Lord finally removed Israel out of his sight. As he has said by all his servants the prophets, so was Israel carried out of their own land to Assyria unto this day. But not Judah. Now, 110 years after this, just to get your time frame, you know, together, 110 years, what do we have to do? We go back to 1880 to get from where we are now today to get the feeling for it. Jerusalem finally was subjugated to the king of Babylon. The city was not destroyed at this point, though. The king of Babylon came and surrounded them, said, surrender. They surrendered. And at that time, 10,000 captives were taken from Judah to Babylon. They had to actually go some fairly near Assyria. They'd make a loop, actually, up to the north from Jerusalem, up to the areas around the area of Assyria, and then down the Euphrates Valley. They did not go straight across to Babylon. That was very, very, very hard country. But they made the loop, went all the way down to the city of Babylon, which is much, much further south than the Israelites, who had been carried captive 110 years before, had gone. So these 10,000 included, by the way, a man named Daniel and another man named Ezekiel. I don't know if you've made the connection or not, but Daniel and Ezekiel were carried captive at the same time and were living in Babylon at the same time. Daniel was in the king's palace, whereas Ezekiel was among the people by the river Kibar, or actually the canal between the two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, near the city of Babylon. And so Ezekiel made his prophecies out there. Daniel wrote his stuff down while he was in the palace. And while they were there, there was another prophet at work in Jerusalem. You know who he was? His name was Jeremiah. So you have three contemporary prophets working at the same time. Jeremiah is still living in Jerusalem. So that while Jerusalem is tributary to Babylon, the city has not been destroyed. They have their own governor. They're living and existing there. 10,000 captives are over in Babylon. And Ezekiel makes his prophecies about Israel from Babylon. Jeremiah makes his prophecies about Israel from Jerusalem. Now, they prophesy about the same time from two different perspectives. They prophesy about the same problems. They prophesy about the same events. They're just looking at it from two different locations. Now, Jeremiah and Ezekiel speak continually of the house of Israel. That's not surprising, because once the house of Israel had gone into captivity, from anyone's perspective, all that was really left was the Jews. They comprised all there was of the house of Israel, and so there was nothing terribly surprising that people would be talking a lot about the house of Israel during this period of time. However, you know, and as you read through them, I think Jeremiah uses the expression house of Israel no less than 19 times, but Ezekiel uses it 83 times, because the prophecies are really strongly directed at the house of Israel. Now, for the curious anomaly that I wanted to tell you about. We're back in Jeremiah, And unfortunately, I have my verses, but I did not write down the chapter. But I think perhaps it's in first or second. I think it's in the second chapter where we are. And you can help me here if you find me. They say, verse 1, if a man put away his wife, where are we? Second chapter? First chapter? Third chapter? Fourth chapter? Jeremiah? Pardon? 3. Okay, thank you very much. Somehow I missed that little item in my notes. They say, if a man put away his wife and she go from him and become another man's, shall he return to her again? Shall not that land be greatly polluted? But you have played the harlot with many lovers, yet return again to me, saith the Lord. Lift up your eyes to the high places and see where you have not been lying with in the days that you have sat for them like the Arabian in the wilderness, and you have polluted the land with your whoredoms and with your wickedness. Therefore the showers have been withheld, there has been no latter rain, you have a whore's forehead, and you will refuse to be corrected. Will you not from this time, verse 4, cry unto me, my father, you are the guide of my youth. Will he reserve his anger forever? Will he keep it to the end? Behold, you have spoken and done evil things as you could. It isn't just, you know, you just if you could do it, you did it. There was no restraint whatsoever to the things that you did. Now, this is a man living in Jerusalem, leading up to the time when they are besieged again. Jeremiah finally tells them, you know, give up to the king of Babylon, you live. You keep fighting him and you're going to die in this city. That's how bad things got before his time was finished. But early on, he's just telling them, look, you people have sinned against God and sinned against God. You just did what you could. The Lord said unto me in the days of Josiah the king, have you seen that which backsliding Israel has done? She's gone up on every high mountain, under every green tree, and played the harlot. And I said, after she had done all these things, turn to me, but she would not turn, and her treacherous sister Judah saw it. Now this is something I suppose some people could read over fairly easily. But take careful note, what he first is describing here is the fact that Israel in the north played the harlot with every god she could possibly find, and Judah, that is the southern kingdom, saw it. He's not using the terms yet house of Israel or house of Judah, but he is drawing the distinction between the two. But remember, the house of Israel is 110 years gone when he actually writes this down. He's looking back to what happened in the past, said they did it, and Judah saw it. And I saw, when for all the causes wherewith backsliding Israel committed adultery, I had put her away and gave her a bill of divorce, yet her treacherous sister Judah feared not, but went and played the harlot also. Judah saw what happened. She saw him go captive. And she went and did exactly the same thing. It came to pass with the lightness of her whoredom, she defiled the land and committed adultery with stones and stocks. What does that mean? Idols. She committed adultery with idols. And yet for all this, her treacherous sister Judah has not returned to me with her whole heart, but she has pretended. That was the difference, by the way, between Judah and Israel. Judah at least made a pretense of turning back to God. Israel never even bothered. The Lord said to me, backsliding Israel has justified herself more than treacherous Judah. Now, anyone living in Jerusalem and hearing Jeremiah's words ought to have heard the drumbeat about this time. Because he said, you're worse here. Israel was more justified than you are here. And you would look and see what happened to Israel. You would say, the hand is writing on the wall for Jerusalem. Now go and proclaim these words toward the north and say, return, you backsliding Israel, said the Lord, and I will not cause my anger to fall upon you, for I am merciful, saith the Lord, and I will not keep anger forever. Only acknowledge your iniquity that you have transgressed against the Lord your God and have scattered your ways to the strangers under every green tree, and you have not obeyed my voice. Turn, O backsliding children, saith the Lord, I am married to you. I'll take you one of a city, I'll take you two of a family, and I'll bring you unto Zion. I'll give you pastors after my own heart, which shall feed you, will feed you with knowledge and with understanding. So, you know, here's the whole thing. I'm going to send messengers to Israel to say, repent, turn back to God, and I'll bring you back. It shall come to pass when you be multiplied and increased in the land in those days, saith the Lord, they shall say no more, the ark of the covenant of the Lord. Now, before I go on, I want to kind of set the stage for you. What all you have read up until this point suggests that Israel went into captivity 110 years before up in the northern regions, up around Assyria, and were placed in some of the cities up there. And it sounds like that with this prophecy, a messenger is being sent up to those cities where Israel had been carried captive. And we're being told, well, if you will repent, I will return you to Zion. That's what it sounds like. Listen to how the prophecy continues. They'll feed you with knowledge. And it shall come to pass when you be multiplied and increased in the land in those days, saith the Lord, they shall say no more the ark of the covenant of the Lord. Neither shall it come to mind, neither shall they remember it, neither shall they visit it, neither shall that be done anymore. Isn't that interesting? Whenever this is, it is at a time when the Ark of the Covenant doesn't matter anymore. Do you know when that would have to be? The only thing that could come to the place where that happens is if God Himself is present. For the Ark of the Covenant was the place of God's presence. It's where God appeared between the cherubim. This little reference is to God actually being present on the earth. At that time they shall call Jerusalem the throne of the Lord, and all the nations shall be gathered unto it, to the name of the Lord, to Jerusalem, neither shall they walk any more after the imagination of their evil heart. In those days, and here's the joker, when are these days? In those days the house of Judah shall walk with the house of Israel. They shall come together out of the land of the north into the land that I have given for an inheritance to your fathers. That has never happened to this day. Never. Because what this is telling you is that at the end time, in those days, the time when God, when Jerusalem is the throne of God, that right at the end time, the house of Israel exists as a separate political entity from the house of Judah. Now, why is that important? Well, because many people believe that when Judah came back under Ezra and Nehemiah, because there were a few refugees of the 10 northern tribes that came back among them, that satisfied this particular requirement. It doesn't even come close. Because the fact is, this speaks of a separate political entity. When Israel fell captive, all sorts of refugees came down to Judah from under the north. And they were joined to the house of Judah. They were a part of the house of Judah, just like Benjamin and Levi were a part of the house of Judah, because we are not talking about the tribe, we are talking about the political entity, which is the house of Judah, in which were Benjamites, Levites, and because they had migrated there, Ephraimites, Manassites, and whoever else it was. These people went captive, and these people came back, and what was reestablished in Jerusalem under Ezra and Nehemiah was the house of Judah. The house of Israel never returned. And the kind of descriptions that you see here never took place either. But what we find, and it's not so subtle either, is that at the time of the end, there are two political entities that exist. The house of Judah, which is really not hard to find today when you look around. The house of Judah is where they have always been. They are in Jerusalem and in Judea and through that part of the Middle East. The house of Judah, that political entity, is there. But also in existence at the end time is a political entity called the house of Israel. Where in the world are they? You certainly can't identify them geographically from the Bible because they're not where they used to be. The only two ways really that are left, or maybe three, are that you can identify them ethnically or you can identify them typologically. In a lot of ways, what you would do is you would go to the Bible and find the prophecies, and in particular the blessings that were pronounced upon Abraham and then upon Joseph, particularly Ephraim and Manasseh, and the other of the tribes of Israel, and see if you can find where those things exist as you come down toward the time of the end. And when you do so, well, I think all of you already know, you find the United States, you find Great Britain, you find Canada, you find Australia, and you also find the nations of northwestern Europe, not including Germany and Poland and the Eastern European countries. In this way, Germany would have to be considered more east. So at the end time, the house of Israel exists as a separate entity from the house of Judah. This is a terribly important thing to understand when you start reading the prophecies in the Old Testament. Historically, only the house of Judah returned from captivity. Then, as I've already commented about the ethnic tribes of Israel that were with them, said nothing about the political entity that was involved. Jeremiah repeatedly refers to the house of Israel, although they have been gone for over 110 years. 8 times in his book, he specifically distinguishes the house of Israel from the house of Judah. The house of Israel and the house of Judah, and 3 of them actually seem to be put into an end time setting. One of them that I think will turn out to be very familiar to you because it's cited at some length in the New Testament is in the 31st chapter of Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 31, and I'll begin reading in verse 27. "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will sow the house of Israel and the house of Judah with the seed of man and the seed of beast." What that means basically is we're going to grow a lot of people. It means all of a sudden, instead of being decimated and in captivity or killed off, that he's going to sow them with animals and with people, and there are going to be a lot of people there. "And it shall come to pass that like I have watched over them to pluck up, to break down, to throw down, to destroy, to afflict, so I will watch over them to build and to plant, saith the Lord. In those days they will no more say, the fathers have eaten a sour grape and the children's teeth are set on edge. Everyone shall die for his own iniquity. Every man that eats the sour grape, his teeth will be set on edge." You're not going to be sitting around saying, well, it's my dad's fault that I'm in this trouble. If you're in trouble, it's your fault. "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah." Now, you've heard it before, haven't you? Chances are the place you've read it most often is in the 8th chapter of Hebrews. And what's interesting about the 8th chapter of Hebrews is that it makes it very clear that covenant is made with Christ, and it also makes it clear that this covenant really isn't made until the very end, something I think that is often overlooked. The Christian covenant that is made with people and renewed in the Lord's Supper is not this covenant. I think it's important to understand the distinction, because this covenant is not made with Gentiles. It's made with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. "Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which covenant they broke, though I was a husband to them. But this shall be the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after those days. I will put my law in their inward parts. I will write it in their hearts. I will be their God. They shall be my people." I don't know why at that point he makes this shift from house of Judah, house of Israel, to house of Israel, but I think I know. I think the reason is because this is the time when he is once again going to make them one kingdom. That the kingdom will be united again instead of divided. "They shall teach no more every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, saith the Lord, for I will forgive their iniquity, I will remember their iniquity no more." Have we got there yet? Nope, we are not to this place. "Thus saith the Lord, which gives the sun for a light by day, and the ordinances of the moon and stars by night, that which divides the sea and the waves thereof roar. The Lord of hosts is his name. If these ordinances depart from before me, saith the Lord, then the seed of Israel shall cease from being a nation before me forever." The seed of Israel. Now, we've read this, and we know that prophetically, Jeremiah on 3 different occasions speaks of the house of Israel, the house of Judah, as separate political entities coming right up to the end time. Then we find this covenant that is made with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, and it's worded in such a way that it leads us to believe that that Judah and Israel become one again. Now, if you'll turn to Ezekiel, and I believe our chapter here is Ezekiel 37. "The word of the Lord came again to me, saying, Son of man, take you one stick, and write upon it for Judah and the children of Israel, his companions. Then take another stick and write upon it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel, his companions." So, now I'm not going to take the time today to go back and lead up to this, but it's very, very apparent in Ezekiel that you are dealing with the latter days. You're dealing with the end time. Now he's told, here's Ezekiel is in captivity. He's by the river Kibar. And he goes out and gets him 2 sticks, and he writes Judah on one and Joseph on the other, because they stand for the 2 separate political entities of the house of Israel and the house of Judah. He says, "Join them one to another into one stick, and they shall become one in your hand. And when the children of your people shall speak to you, saying, Will you show us what you mean by this. Okay? Here is the interpretation of this prophecy. Say unto them, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel his fellows, and I will put them with him, even with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they shall be one in my hand. The sticks whereon you write shall be in your hand before their eyes, and say to them, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will take the children of Israel from among the heathen, where they be gone. I will gather them on every side, and bring them into their own land, and I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be to them all, and they shall be no more two nations. Neither shall it be divided into two kingdoms any more at all. There is absolutely no way that this was fulfilled when Nehemiah came back from captivity along with a remnant of a few scattered Israelites who were a part of Judah at that time. Because it speaks not ethnically merely of these people. It speaks of them as political entities. They are two nations, two peoples, two governments, two separate entities that exist as two separate kingdoms. And they did in parallel for 250 years. And it was a great source of enormous pain and frustration to all the people through all that period of time. And there was a yearning to be one again. Does that sound familiar to any of you, of the divisions that even take place among church people? And the yearning and the desire to be one again, and yet it can't happen. It just doesn't happen. And in fact, where it came to Israel and it came to Judah, the only way that could possibly take place is if God made it happen. He goes on to say, I'll make them one nation. Verse 23, they'll not defile themselves anymore with their idols, nor with their detestable things, nor with any of their transgressions. I'll save them out of their dwelling places wherein they have sinned. I will cleanse them. They will be my people. I will be their God. And in case you had some other question about it, the timing, David my servant shall be king over them. They shall have one shepherd. They shall walk in my judgments, observe my statutes, and do them. And they shall dwell in the land that I have given to Jacob my servant, wherein your fathers have dwelt, and they shall dwell therein, they and their children and their children's children forever. The return under Ezra and Nehemiah did not fulfill that, for they were out of the land again. That land was totally dominated by Arabs until really the beginnings of the return under the Zionists and finally the Balfour Declaration, which made it possible for the Jews to go back and to claim their own land again. It said forever and forever. And what you're seeing there now is not a fulfillment of it either. For there is no political union of the house of Judah with the house of Israel, because nobody knows where the house of Israel is or who they are. Moreover, I will make a covenant of peace with them. It should be an everlasting covenant with them. I will place them, multiply them, and set my sanctuary in the midst of them forevermore. My tabernacle will be with them. Yes, I will be their God. They shall be my people. And the heathen will know that I, the Lord, do sanctify Israel when my sanctuary will be in the midst of them forevermore. Didn't happen. There's going to have to be another sanctuary to last forevermore. Because that one, the one that Nehemiah built, is just long gone. Now, I think this is really fascinating to look at and understand these things. I was looking in the Ryrie Study Bible this morning, and it has a comment on verse 21. Verse 21 of this says, I say unto them, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will take the children of Israel from among the heathen, whither they are gone. I will gather them on every side and bring them to their own land. Here's what the Ryrie Study Bible says about this. Promises for Israel that will be fulfilled at the second coming of Christ include restoration to the land of Palestine, unification of the two kingdoms, purification from all idolatry, Messiah ruling over them, possession of the land forever, and the presence of God and his sanctuary in the midst of the people. This admits to two kingdoms, that the two kingdoms exist as separate political entities until the return of Christ. And nobody says, where's the house of Israel? I gather whoever did the Ryrie Study Bible never tumbled to that particular question, which they raised in their own commentary. It just leaps off the page at me. Probably most people it doesn't. But it acknowledges the fact. To me, the whole question of the identity of Israel in the end time starts with what I've given you today. It starts with the establishment of the fact that the house of Israel and the house of Judah are separate political entities at the end time. Then comes the task, where in the world is the house of Israel? Where have they gone? In fact, hardly anybody seems to ask that question, but how would you identify them if you're going to go about the task? Where would you start? Where would you look? There have been a lot of efforts made to identify Israel ethnically. Judah's Scepter and Joseph's Birthright, which is probably familiar to many of you by J.H. Allen, it's out of print long since, but they maybe find copies somewhere. It was an interesting book, and it raised, I think, a lot of questions. It answered a lot of questions. It worked its way through a lot of theories about the migration of Israel down through time, and I think had some very valid points. It was not without its problems and its detractors as time went on, however. Of course, you also have the identity movements in the modern world, which are, in some ways, white racists and white supremacists in their approach to these things, and that's wrong, too. The British Israel Society, I think, had some aspects of it correct, other aspects of it wrong. What is beginning to take place now, though, there's another movement entirely independently of this arising from Jews who are asking exactly the question that I'm asking here today. Where is the house of Israel? Because they know the question has got to be answered. And they are coming to the same conclusions that J.H. Allen came to years and years ago. The United States and the British Commonwealth. I think their reasoning is somewhat different. I think the aspects of their conclusions are different, but nevertheless, they are coming to precisely the same questions. I mean, same answers that J.H. Allen came to. Identifying Israel typically from the Bible is a piece of cake. When you go back, for example, and look at the prophecies concerning Joseph, that his sons would be a nation and a company of nations, that they would be great, that they would possess the gates of their enemies, you go down and really start analyzing the promises made to Abraham, the promises made to Joseph, and start looking for those people today. There is no way that you would come up with anything except the United States and Great Britain and the British Commonwealth of Nations. Where have the promises made to Abraham and the blessing upon Joseph been fulfilled at last? And what modern nations do the prophecies of Israel fit? When I was a freshman at Hardin-Simmons University, I had a friend who was studying for the Baptist ministry. A fervent student of the Bible, loved to read the Bible. And I think maybe the second year before he made the statement he made to him. We'd been to the library one day, and we were walking out and standing on the steps of the library. And he said, I've been reading in the first few chapters of Isaiah. And I said, yeah. And he said, what I read there, he said, fits our country, our nation, right now, to a T. It fits us right down to the ground. And I said to him, that's very interesting you should say that, because I've been doing some study that indicates that we are Israel. He looked at me kind of funny, and he never brought it up again. He saw, typologically, from the Bible, we fit the mold. I mean, if you put the key in the lock, and you turn it, and the lock clicks, you really have a pretty good idea that you got the right key, right? And the truth is that when you begin to compare, not only typologically, the United States and Great Britain with the promises, but then you hit the prophets. And the prophets describe the morals. They describe the trends. They describe the society of Israel at the time. And we fit that like the key fits the lock. And the frightening thing is, as God turned the key in the lock once before, he will do it again. Because he is the Lord. He changes not. Well, when Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Isaiah speak of the sins and the captivity of Joseph and the house of Israel at the time of the end, they can only be talking about the English-speaking peoples and their Western European brethren. And it brings from the prophets a condemnation in the strongest terms and a call for repentance that, by and large, has been ignored. And it will be ignored for some time yet. If you read these prophets, you can only come to one conclusion for our peoples. Hard times lie ahead. The call of the prophet can be heeded by any individual, and we can see to ourselves and to our families. But candidly, unless something happens to change this nation from the top down, we're in a lot of trouble. Read the prophets.
You have heard Ronald L. Dart. If you would like additional information on available tapes and materials, write to Christian Educational Ministries, Post Office Box 560, White House, Texas 75791.